It's my distinct pleasure to introduce Richard Thieme. Richard's been giving talks here at DEF CON for 19 years. That's absolutely incredible. I don't want to embarrass him and tell him what I was doing 19 years ago. But, you know, whenever I go home, certainly being a goon and the old team that I was on, I usually missed most of the talks, but I always make time to go back and listen to Richard's talks. And this is going to be great, and it's also kind of cool. He was actually a guest on Coast to Coast AM, which I've been listening to since I was a kid. So it is my distinct pleasure to introduce Richard Thieme.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, it really has been 19 years, and I know you start to look, as someone tweeted, like a deranged old man wandering around the con, and that was 3 years ago. So you accept your destiny. Josh Corman, who some of you know, Calvary man, he said, I want to talk to you and Dan Gere. I want to pick your brains while we still have you. And people used to not say that. So you have to deal with how you're perceived. And one of the things that it has done to grow older is you say, I've got to tell the whole truth as I know it, as I see it, for what it's worth. You have one brief span, right, to hold that bright, shining torch. And instead of whining and complaining that the world won't dedicate itself to make you happy, you want it to blaze as brightly as possible. And you want, at the end of your life, to be all used up because you have expended all the energy you have got in doing that and trying to be of service and value to the people you have come to love, which includes this weird collection of people here at DEF CON. So, let's get going. The only way to tell the truth is through fiction. Where did that come from? Let's see if we can get this to work. Nope. Keeps doing the same thing. There we go. All right. It is. No wonder how complicated things get, what with one thing leading to another, said E.B. White, and he wasn't kidding. It's a Mobius strip. In other words, when you set off on the journey to find out what's real, you are walking on one side of the strip, and you are convinced that there is another side of the strip, and as you come around, you know how a Mobius strip works, you find yourself always on the same side. My intention is to describe here what the world since World War II has become. I did this at Besides and asked who had been born during or before World War II, and my hand was the only one that went up. In this room, there are probably a few more. I see some graybeards, but not many of you might know in a non-contextual way that how we have come to live and accept reality for what it is different than it was before the Cold War, which created postmodernism and deconstructionism as a necessity to understand or have a beginning of a clue to understand what's going on. I know we love to say, a la the Matrix in Neo, you take the red pill, but my experience is the deeper you go after taking the red pill, the more lavender it becomes. And you've got a red and purple pill all the way down. We can never get to the bottom of it because the Mobius strip brings us back to where we began. So what I want to do is describe the conditions as I see them and hope that you will not respond as some people do to when I do the talk on UFOs and government, how the government responded to UFO phenomena for 60 years by saying, I don't want to know that, because the national security state has created that as an essential bubble in which people will live their lives by choice, because the cognitive dissonance of knowing what is real in our lives, in our society, and in our nation is too painful, too discordant. Remember what Nietzsche said a long time ago. When one is confronted with the unknown or danger or discomfort, the first instinct is to abolish the discomfort and the pain. Any explanation, he said, is better than none. Because what you want to do is get your head rid of oppressive representations. One is not particular about how we get rid of them. The first one that explains it in a familiar and comforting way is the one that people grab a hold of. And the proof of pleasure is the criterion for truth. And therefore, people believe a construction of reality which is congruent with their altogether present and previous construction of reality rather than allowing anomalous information in because it simply causes too much discomfort. And we call that explanation the truth. And then when we pass it around to other people, we have an agreement and a consensus, and then it becomes orthodoxy and even scientific truth. So, let us begin. I'm going to be talking about mind games, my book, which I'll be doing a signing 10 tomorrow, but of course I always have a backpack heavier full of books than I can carry if someone wants to buy one for a mere $20 before then. How did I come to write Mind Games? I can talk about this now in a way that I couldn't before Snowden. There's pre-Snowden life and there's post-Snowden life, even more than Manning and Assange. Shortly after 9/11, because of the friends and close colleagues I've made in and through this organizational structure, such as it is, there were some people from the National Security Agency who were very concerned after 9/11 because the executive order that came from the Bush White House asked them to do things which in their maturity and wisdom they had internalized we'd never do. We never do it because it's contrary to the Constitution and to the law. And they knew I had started writing in the 90s about how technology would lead and transform not only geopolitical boundaries and the way we have to behave in those in the new geopolitical world constructed by the digital transformation, but we would have to rethink ethics itself because our religious structures and our way of thinking about what is the right thing would also be transformed by the necessity of doing things which prior to 9/11 and prior to World War II, in fact, we found unthinkable because in the construction of reality by the prior technologies, they couldn't be done, but they could after 9/11. And they had been contrary to the Constitution and the law as they understood it because that understanding was constructed, as I say, by the framework created by prior technologies, which shapes the context of our lives. It's the ground in which the figure of our lives is drawn. So, I began working with some people there ad hoc, off-site, for about a decade on how to reframe ethical issues or considerations in light of the brave new world that those executive orders created. And make no mistake, they came from Bush originally because they had to, but Obama is more Bush than Bush on all of those issues, as well as on privacy leaks and punishing whistleblowers and most of you know that, so it's not a partisan issue. It's what you do when you have the power to do it. And they were concerned with how to inflect the conversation inside the agency, if it was at all possible, in a direction that took into account what was now happening as a result of the new instructions. So I worked with them on those issues. We reflected on it. I want to say for the record, nothing classified was ever shared in those discussions. I know nothing classified. No one ever said anything that was classified. And if they did, there is no way I would know it was classified. So I get to stay in America and live my life happily. And I do not have to kowtow to my Russian feeders who over a lifetime know how to give the food, take the food away, and ultimately assimilate you into the long-term plan they have for you. So the conversations were about sensitive issues, and at one point in them, a deputy director of the agency said, you know, you can't ever discuss what we talk about with you. And then he said, well, unless you start writing fiction. Fiction is the only way you can tell the truth. And that rang such a bell for me because, as I found in Tim Melly's wonderful book, The Covert Sphere, here was an academic in Ohio, wrote a whole book on exactly that same theme, because post-World War II, fiction has become the only way we can tell the truth, and that is true for people inside the community as well. So I began writing stories. I've published about 35, and this year I will soon finish a novel called Foam, and 20 or 19 stories were collected in Mind Games. Now, you can't read that. I do that once in a while to show you why the Challenger went down. They couldn't read the slide about the O-ring. Because there was so much dense information in small print on the slide that its importance was lost in the sheer density of it. Well, this, believe it or not, is a tweet. Now, I know a tweet is only 144 characters. I'm not as stupid as I look. But the top is the tweet, and it said, compare this, and what he did is list many things that Snowden had outed using proprietary information, and he said, compare it with this. And what it's, well, that didn't work. What it's compared with is a long passage that he photographed and attached to his tweet, which is the words of a dying intelligence agent who says, let me tell you, in effect, what we do. And he did a point-by-point comparison of what Snowden had outed and what my short story had said. Now, when the short story was published, I got a phone call from a different friend at the agency, and he said, this reminds me of 3 Days of the Condor, the Redford movie about the analyst who reads fiction to find out what's going on. 95% of your story isn't fiction, he said, but you have to know which 95% to have the key to the code. So he was right, and we agreed that people would think the stuff about Roswell, my little sci-fi scenario of aliens crashing their scout ship loaded with computer chips and fiber optics and the like, so that humans would build the internet because they were finding it so boring and tedious to go to cocktail parties in Georgetown to try to learn everything they could about us. And it was so much easier to give us the means of building the internet onto which we would then project the total contents of our lives and work and souls. And they could just download Earth thinking, which was much more convenient. Well, this is an agent saying, let me tell you what we do. I'm not going to read the whole thing. You can look at the story in the book. It's called Zero Day Roswell. But the part of the story that was true was all the things that he said is what we do, because I knew that this is what we do. The story was published in 2006. Now, Tim Melly, the academic I mentioned, said this: when democracy relies on entertainment to provide knowledge of its secret affairs, as in fact all of the stories one way or another in mind games do, the contradictions of empire are normalized to invisibility through a blurring of fictional and real operations. Now, here's an example. Animal Farm was an animated film, full-length animated film. I still call them cartoons because that's what we called them when I was growing up. But it was a full-length film of the George Orwell book, Animal Farm, and it was made by the CIA. It was created entirely by the CIA, manufactured by the CIA, and disseminated by the CIA through other fronts. And that was typical of what was being done in the 1950s. It was a suspension of democracy, a conscious decision by the government to suspend democracy in its actions in order to preserve democracy in its fictional context, i.e., our lives. And in that context, the CIA in the 50s and 60s became one of the largest sponsors of art and literature in the world. They stood up magazines, periodicals. My own encounter with that was I took a course at Northwestern from Stephen Spender, the British intellectual, and he was the editor of Encounter. And Encounter for 20 years was the leading non-communist left-wing periodical in Europe, intellectual periodical. And he claimed at the end, his wife Natasha said he was so naive he probably meant it, that he didn't know that for those 20 years, the only reason funds continued to flow into the magazine is that from the beginning to the end, it was a CIA operation. And there were 20 other major periodicals in the world and many other minor periodicals, as well as using the periodicals in the media of the world or making movies. The CIA published, not under its own imprint, but through regular publishers, things are not what they seem, over 1,000 books. It appointed itself a Ministry of Culture to combat the Soviet Ministry of Culture. And the way George Kennan put it George Kennan was one of the formulators of our foreign policy under Eisenhower, and he said, we need to act after the 1947 National Security Act in such a way that the U.S. can publicly disclaim any responsibility for the covert actions we do, because Eisenhower realized early on, you can read a book called Total Cold War, 600 pages about that, Eisenhower realized that in the absence of a nuclear exchange, which sane men and women would not have, the only way to win and fight the Cold War was through words, icons, glyphs, symbols, through propaganda, through disinformation. And there was no way to do disinformation that did not cause blowback, that is, that did not include all of the American people in the false scenarios and creative narratives that came out and through the media into the mind of society without having everybody part of that disinformation campaign. You couldn't deceive the Soviets without deceiving the American people. And so the American people themselves became subject to the propaganda campaign that we instituted in order to fight the Cold War. I mentioned Kennan. He was the formulator of that policy. There's also brothers, John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles, John Foster at State, Alan at CIA, who worked in tandem to create the kind of world they did. And their first adventure was to overthrow Mossadegh in Iran at the behest of the British, who were afraid their oil interests were going to be nationalized by a duly elected, democratically elected head of government. And then we did our bends in Guatemala. And to do our bends, Eisenhower called on Eddie Bernays, the father of spin, to do it properly. And the whole religious system in Guatemala was used. Priests were stood up and fed the kinds of lies that they had to promulgate from the parish to the faithful who believed them about false things about our bends, so they would fear him and support the overthrow again of a democratically elected government. So the Cold War became a war fought through symbols, words, propaganda, and still we have a military presence one way or another in about 150 countries. So we are still creating the same kind of fictions that we began to do then. As I say, it began under Eisenhower. Kennan sponsored it, and I'm going to give you an example. Kennan said, "They have fought us with unreality, with irrationalism. Can we combat this unreality successfully with rationalism and with truth?" And the answer was no. They lie, we have to lie, and that became the method of exchange, the shaping of the mind of society, not only in the globe, but in our country as well. And the problem was that when you do that, in a nation that is now governed by compartmentalization, one of my friends at NSA said, you know more about the big picture, that pointillism standing back, because you talk to so many different people and you sure know how to connect the dots. He said, I'm constrained by compartmentalization. The example he gave was that he only recently found out that a program he worked on at the agency in the 1980s, while stood up for one purpose, actually had a completely different covert purpose, and none of the people working on the program knew what that ultimate real intention and aim of their program was for about 20 years, because they did not have a need to know. And therefore, people inside the IC are often subjected to the same propaganda, the same narratives that we are, because they can't go elsewhere inside the IC to ask what the truth is. And out here, we kind of can, but we can only express it without fear of jail or exile in fiction. So let's look at an example. The search for the Manchurian candidate. You're all familiar with brainwashing as a concept, correct? We all know what brainwashing is. It's terrible, and it's to be feared. We fall into the clutches of evildoers, and they so work on us, or they use drugs, or they manipulate our brains with bombardments of electromagnetic pulses, and pretty soon we're doing exactly what they said. And the Manchurian candidate was promulgated through American Life in fiction by Richard Condon, and then it was turned into a movie with Frank Sinatra, which was even better, because who doesn't believe Frank Sinatra, right? And so brainwashing became part of the fabric of our understanding of what the Chinese and the Russians would do to our poor guys if they were caught and subjected to it. But let's look at where brainwashing came from. Do you know the term came from a guy named Edward Hunter? He was a journalist. He was one of the many, many journalists who had contracts with the CIA. In fact, he himself was simply an agent of the CIA, as he subsequently revealed. He invented the concept of brainwashing as part of a propaganda campaign to mobilize support for our massive military buildup in the early 1950s. Dulles at State believed in what he read about brainwashing. How could Dulles buy that from his own agent? And I'll give you another example of that in a minute, of how easily that could happen, thanks to Secretary of State Haig and what he showed us. So they believed about brainwashing, what we came to believe about it. We were in a panic about it, and we needed to find out how it worked. So we began experimenting on North Korean prisoners in the same insidious ways we said they were experimenting on us, because in it, like the digital world, if anywhere, anything anywhere is a threat, you have to control the whole world. That's the rationale of our cyber thinking right now and our terroristic thinking. You can't have anybody get through. So you spend a significant amount of money more than you would if you accepted some casualties and some damage. But our intention in dealing with brainwashing was to fuel anxiety about communism and its methods. Meanwhile, inside, of necessity, given what we thought they were doing to us, we needed to find out how these methods worked. And the programs that we instituted, things like, you probably know the names, Bluebird, Artichoke, MKUltra. We only know about those programs because when the director of CIA ordered all references to them destroyed, kind of like Indiana Jones in the warehouse, he forgot one box. There was one box of 50,000 financial documents, which enabled us to connect the dots on what we were doing and what these programs were about. And that's the only reason we know about it. You see, when I asked the lead historian at NSA, what can you and I discuss historically, with the assumption that by using the same words, we actually mean the same events, he laughed and he said, anything up until World War II. He wasn't kidding. It was kind of a joke, but he was saying that when this world, OSS morphing into CIA in the late 40s, when this world really got underway, the world in which we live, it was like listening to a symphony in a hall with a lot of dead spaces. There are a lot of lacunae because of genuinely maintained secrecy, and it's hard to connect a dot to a non-dot and come up with a coherent schema. Well, Artichoke and MKUltra, these were horrific. We had a guy in Cameron. He was the head of the American Psychiatric Association and the Canadian. We did it in Canada, in Montreal, so we would have plausible deniability, which is what smart Eisenhower insisted he have throughout his 8 years of tenure as president. Do what you must, but keep my fingerprints off it. The things that Cameron did were horrific. He wiped people's minds as much as humanly possible and then tried to reprogram and repattern them. It never worked. Why did it never work? Because the Russians and the Chinese did not have any exotic techniques. When they turned people against us, it was through their time-honored techniques of brutality and interrogation used consistently with the cultures, Chinese and Russian, and the way they did things always. There was nothing arcane or secret or particularly spooky about it. But these movies and these books, The Manchurian Candidate, put that into our brains as a reality. So the fiction created even more of a fiction, and the search for what did not exist led to our establishment of KUBARC, the Counterintelligence Interrogation Manual, which simulated brainwashing we anticipated would be done to us and subjected our people to it to prepare them for what we thought they would do to us when we were captured. But in fact, that manual turned into our positive, our offensive manual for interrogation and the SEER program. The Unit is a TV program, episode 8 says the team participates in SEER, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape, a training drill, and they're treated as prisoners of war. The drill pushes them to their mental and physical limits when the doctor who runs SEER places their lives in danger. So people watch that program on television and believed it because fiction promulgated the lie at a higher level of reinforcement. And it wasn't that successful a series, but it nevertheless seeped into the mind of society. And then after 9/11, when we were going to interrogate prisoners and torture them, and I don't mean waterboarding, which is the go-to poster boy for tepid torture. I'm talking about oops deaths, as an interrogator described it to me, where you're just working a little too hard, and you say, oops, he's gone. And then you called in a doctor to falsify the death certificate and say that he died of natural causes, documented by Steve Miles in his concern about doctors being used, in contrary to our own principles at Nuremberg, to monitor torture and improve on it from interrogation to interrogation, which result came from him going point by point through thousands of documents unearthed by the ACLU about who was where when interrogation took place and how it was done. A subject which I talked to the bioethicist at the AMA about exploring a little more, and he refused. He said, if there's enough groundswell of support for looking at that, we will, but that's not our concern. Well, it isn't our concern, but the irony is that that SEER manual then became the template for how we interrogated and tortured people all down the Mobius Strip, all back from the Mobius Strip, when that pseudo-journalist working for the CIA created the notion of brainwashing, and it began its long journey into your minds, so that even while I'm speaking, there's at least somebody in this room who is saying, because of the discordance it creates, I don't want to know that. I don't want to know that. I would rather do away with the discomfort of knowing, because if the world you're describing is real, then how do I know what is real? And then the world tilts. And it's like riding the rotor at the old Riverview amusement park in Chicago. The floor falls away, and you're standing in the middle of the air, not sure where the firm ground is. And therefore, as Nietzsche said, you will adopt a schema or narrative or understanding of reality that makes you feel better regardless of how true it is. My exploration of how the government responded to UFO phenomena is full of that kind of response. Okay, so that's what happened with brainwashing. Now, I said I would tell you how it is that we come to know that we can deceive ourselves because of the chains of command and need to know. What you're looking at is the Soviet submarine, the K-129. It was a nuclear submarine, and it went down. And we wanted to retrieve it. But we didn't want the Soviets to know we were retrieving it. Now, along the assumptions that I've spelled out, this is what we did. This is the Hughes Glomer Explorer built by Sunship to secretly lift a sunken Soviet submarine at the height of the Cold War. This wasn't the only project. This was through Howard Hughes. But a gentleman called me, and this is where you get some of your information. People who have retired or are dying, and they just want to say something, because the burden of not ever telling the truth about your own life and your own reality. Someone told me the other day about their grandfather or father who was in NSA, and what it did to his marriage for him to disappear for 4 months at a time and come back and be able to say nothing. Or as a friend at NSA said the other day, kind of chuckling, a young man was coming into the agency, just gotten his clearances, and he was and his parents, who worked at NSA, were very concerned. Why? Because he didn't know that they worked at NSA, and they had lived with the family lie all their lives. Do you see that the very basis, if you want to look at what privacy, the lack of it, does to intimacy, or the lack of truth-telling does to the possibility of trust, you have those examples which are redolent throughout the intelligence community where people are bound to speak only to one another according to the strictures and rubrics of their agency, but not to anyone who matters in their lives except through lies. The only way they can tell the truth is through fiction, but never the whole classified reality. Well, I got a call from a gentleman who was stood up by the CIA to create a proprietary, that is a false front, for a group like Hughes's group that was going to build a deep sea diving submersible that would let us go down and get that submarine back up. Why do it two times? Why do it three times? One, because you can, like the dog in the joke that I won't repeat. And two, because when you put people in competition with each other in genuine ways, it's going to spur creativity. Both of these organizations did good deep sea diving exploration and work. They made money. They were successful. But the covert purpose for which they really existed was to create something to bring back up that submarine. And my friend, he said, you know how we had meetings about that. And this is where you say to me, oh, people can't keep secrets. Yes, they can. The meetings would take place deep underground in bunkers. People would come from all over the country for the meetings, go way down. We would have our conversations come up, and the meeting never happened. There are no records. There are no notes. And if you use the Freedom of Information Act, as friends both at Interpol and FBI have told me, you will never get what you want now because they learned how to game the system and use code to put the relevant documents in a different file that has a different name that you will never know. Therefore, your request will not be honored with the documents you seek. And if a few do turn up, it will cost you a lot of money for copying. So he led that project. And then a few weeks... just weeks before it was finished, he had to leave and move on to something else. And when he saw someone he had worked with on the project, he knew they had gone down. What happened actually was part of it broke off and fell back down, but part of it came up. And what we received from that information is still classified. And he asked his colleague and friend, so what did we find when we went down? And he said, I'm sorry, sir, you no longer have a need to know because you're not on the project anymore. So he, like me, like all of us, had to wait 20 years for the whole project to be declassified. Like MKUltra, I refer to Susan Hassler in the notes on the disc that you received. She wrote two great books. They're worth reading, Intelligence and Project Half Sheep, How the Agency's Alien Got High. And that second book is about Project MKUltra and how they tested drugs on people, what they did to people. She can only talk about it now because it's distant in time and therefore no longer a threat. And that's one of the things you have to do is just wait. Wait until it's no longer potent, and then you can tell more of the truth, and it doesn't matter anymore. Susan, her first book, I think my first sentence in my review of Intelligence, which is on your disc and it's also at the Amazon site, was there is enough anger, white-hot anger in this book to steam a skunk. Because she was so angry over the politicization of the CIA during the Bush administration. And if you want to see what Susan looks like, go to the HBO documentary In Search of Bin Laden, and you will see that post 9/11, she worked with the cadre of people as an analyst to seek to connect those dots. So, even someone working on the project might not even know what it's about or where it winds up, unless somebody writes a story about it, the Manchurian Candidate. Because elements of the national security state are committed to the production of strategic fictions, simulations, and deceptions, as Melly said it, the mind of society must become confused about what is real and rely on postmodern deconstruction in a futile attempt to discern what is really happening in the wilderness of mirrors. I remember sitting in the rain with a friend from NSA, and I was telling him what I thought was going on, and he said, noticing my symptoms of secondary trauma, which were very real and predictable from the conversations I was having with people, including those who tortured and were tortured, he said, you know enough to know what's not true, but you can't necessarily connect all of the dots to know what is true. And you have to learn to live with that ambiguity and anxiety in your constant need-to-know machine effort to figure out what's real in your life. When I grew up, I was told that seeking what was real and acting on it was what we were called to do as human beings. But I didn't know that the societal context in which I lived would undermine that very project and make it impossible to complete, which is why I say the red pill turns into a lavender pill. The most effective way of doing this kind of propaganda is not just to lie. It is to provide a mixture of truths, half-truths, and lies. That's the best propaganda, and that's the most effective, because it can connect like children's blocks plugging into one another with the schemas or narratives already in our heads, snap into place like those beads. If it connects to what we already believe is true, and it sounds like that, we will build the module up in our minds and believe it is true. So this can get us in a real, real mess. Let me give you an example. See, there's Alexander Haig, Secretary of State. This is where it began, this particular story, in a small Italian newspaper where a piece of really great investigative reporting revealed that the KGB during the Cold War was sponsoring terrorism all over the world and supporting groups that were antithetical to the United States and its intentions. That small story caught the attention of an author and a journalist who wrote a piece about it for the New York Times and also wrote a book about it. And that came to the attention of Alexander Haig, who was Secretary of State. And he became very, very alarmed. And he held a press conference in which he demanded that the CIA explore this revelation in order to counter the nefarious and insidious work of the KGB in this way. William Casey, I believe it was, director of the CIA, said, we'll get right on it. And then 6 months later, the result came back. We've explored that, and you don't have to worry about that particular thing. Why? Because the story in the Italian newspaper was a CIA plant in the first place. In other words, it was just propaganda to smear the Soviets, but it was picked up by our own journalists who didn't know any better and couldn't, turned into a book which went to the Secretary of State, and then it became an alarming consideration, and the CIA could not tell him the truth. Well, finding out what's true is not easy. You know the story of the gnome in the woods. A man went into the woods to find the gold, And he got a hold of a gnome, which according to folklore has to tell the truth. And he said, which is the tree under which the gold is buried? And the gnome had to point it out. And he said, I'm going to go get a shovel. He tied his scarf around the tree. He said, you have to promise not to remove the scarf. And the gnome, promised he would not. And he went and got the shovel and he came back. And the gnome had kept his promise. He had not removed the scarf, but he had tied a scarf around every tree in the forest. This is what it becomes like to find the gold of the truth. In the book that I talked about last year, UFOs and Government, a Historical Inquiry, it's in over 50 university libraries now. It's at Yale, it's at the University of Chicago, it's the University of Basel in Switzerland. Why? Because it is bulletproof. Because we only use documents which over half a century our team of nine unearthed and took 5 years to create a seamless historical narrative to show how the government responded to the phenomena in light of national security concerns. But even though we promulgate that information, it will be forgotten as soon as we said it. Why? It doesn't reach into our lives in a visceral way, the way the draft did during the 60s, turning young people into the street. It didn't reach into the lives of normal middle-class Americans like the Depression did in the 30s. And therefore, there is what you can call motivated forgetting. We have the experience or we hear the words and then we don't remember it. And the machinery of deception and cover, illusions, misdirection and distraction, and if necessary, ridicule or silence by authoritative voices, it just reinforces that fact. So this is from the UFO story as we told it last year, and I'm just pointing out that this was used as an example of cover and deception. This is what the CIA decided in 1953 after a flurry of sightings over Washington. They're not a threat to national security, but the reports are. Military personnel should be trained in proper observation. Programs should be created to debunk flying saucers to the citizenry. That policy really has never really stopped. Study them, learn what we can about the technology. Do not allow our enemies to learn what we know about the technology or even believe they exist. And so of necessity, the citizens of the United States, ridiculed and debunked and rejected, were treated as if they were enemies. And that's what Hynek said when he finally gave up, the astronomer. He said the public was in fact placed in the role of the enemy, against whom counter-espionage tactics must be employed. I frequently felt those in charge considered people who even took an interest in UFOs and wanted to know about them were treated as enemies. It is not just about that. It is about everything Snowden did as well. Okay, do you know who that is? Somebody tell me who that is. Thank you. Everybody knows who Jack Bauer is. If I showed you Hague and asked that question, very few of you would know who it was. But you know who Jack Bauer was. Well, listen to this quote now from Justice Scalia, citing 24 as relevant background for constitutional jurisprudence. This is a quote. Jack Bauer saved Los Angeles. He saved hundreds of thousands of lives, Scalia said. Recalling season 2, where his rough interrogation tactics saved California from a terrorist nuke, the Supreme Court judge etched a line in the sand. Are you going to convict Jack Bauer? He challenged his fellow judges. Say the criminal law is against him, as if the law doesn't matter. You have the right to a jury trial. Is there any jury in America that would convict Jack Bauer? I don't think so. So the question, this wonderful jurist concluded, question is whether we believe in absolutes and ought we believe in absolutes. And his decision, obviously, was to believe them. Well, the Earth to Scalia communication was, Jack Bauer doesn't exist. It's fiction. But the way the program was promulgated through the program 24, and I'm working with a guy named Robbie Graham who's doing a wonderful book. It's on CIA influence and military influence in regard to UFOs. But it's how they manipulated and managed that program, which I just mentioned in passing, to debunk the citizenry in order to alter the media that came into the mind of society from the 1950s on, and it's all documented. If I have time, I'll get to it. Well, I'll say something right now. Space Wars, that's by a friend of mine, William B. Scott. Bill Scott said he could not get people to listen to what he was saying about how a small non-state actor supported by a state actor in the background could impair our satellite functioning significantly. And he was told by our director in Hollywood, look, if you, and he told me this, he said, you make one mistake from the podium in what you say is true, you're ridiculed, your reputation is destroyed, and through the various wraparound reinforcing outlets of media, the mouthpieces of the media that are used, you will no longer have credibility. But if you make it fiction, he said, it's mind candy. He said, here in Hollywood, we've been doing that about things for a long, long time because mind candy goes down easily and people just eat it and absorb it and it goes into their mind and they just take it for what it is. So he wrote a novel called Space Wars to try to get the point across. It also keeps him safe. I don't want to go there yet. Well, all right, I'll go there. You know who that is, right? More of you would recognize Dustin Hoffman probably playing Carl Bernstein, but that's Carl Bernstein. I want you to look at the face, look at the posture. This is what it looks like to be a lean and hungry reporter who wants to do investigative reporting, okay? Flash forward to when he came to Milwaukee to talk about his new book. I think it was about Hillary, his biography. And I asked him about the article he wrote for Rolling Stone in 1978. It was about 20,000 words. And he documented all of the journalists, all of the media, Paley at CBS, Time Life, the Luces, Cronkite, how back at the UFO thing, they wanted to use Arthur Godfrey and then use Cronkite to do a false program on UFO phenomena in order to debunk it. And I said, you showed how the CIA and the journalists and the media were just lockstep from the 50s and 60s on. What do you say to that now? And he said, to my astonishment, oh, the boys at CIA don't have time for that now. Okay, so this is lean and hungry. This is what he looked like when he said that. I just want to say that 400 pounds later, there's a significant suggestion that you have become assimilated by the very powers against which you so hungrily pursued the truth at one time. We'll go back to that for the moment. So what did we do with UFOs and TV? There was a comic strip called Steve Canyon, and it was turned into a TV program. And it had a serious single episode about UFOs in which Canyon reflected on, I've got to get out there and find out what's happening. And the Air Force took the script and rewrote it. So instead of saying, as Canyon did in the first script, the person making this report is a solid, clear-headed citizen, instead they changed it so that he responded with skepticism and said, this isn't even worth investigating. And it got that point across. You don't have to take my word for it. Charles Lewis just wrote a book called 935 Lies, and he talked about his experience in journalism working at CBS on 60 Minutes with Don Hewitt, and how any time they had tried to prepare a significant investigative piece about someone who was thick with Don Hewitt or the other executives at CBS, they were told not to touch it. Than anyone with significant money, influence, or power. And the same thing with ABC. He said when he worked with Ruane Aldridge, he killed a tough story on tobacco because Philip Morris was in the process of engaging in a lawsuit with him at the time. And I've talked before about Gene Pope at National Enquirer, who in 1952 was doing psychological operations for the CIA and invented the National Enquirer in 53, and he didn't make money until the 60s, and money came through Frank Costello and the Mafia into his coffers to sustain it. All that time it was in the red, and when he died, odd for someone running such a disreputable rag, the eulogy at his funeral was delivered by Melvin Laird, who was Secretary of Defense at the time. So I'm not making this up. Let me quote from the 1991 Task Force report on greater CIA openness, compiled by the CIA director, the newly appointed Openness Task Force. It said, and I'm quoting now, this is 91, the CIA has relationships with reporters from every major wire service, newspaper, Newsweekly, and television network in the nation. They have helped us turn intelligence failure stories into intelligence success stories. It has contributed to the accuracy of countless others as we consider accuracy. He goes on to reveal that the CIA has in the past persuaded reporters to postpone, change, hold, or scrap stories that could adversely affect national security interests as we constituted. So,
Let's see, it's almost time, so I'm going to bring this to a conclusion by pointing out that Mobius strip is serious. In this book, Mind Games, you've got the Zero Day Roswell story. There's one called Break Memory, which describes how the masters of society moderate the media and our very understanding and work on hackers who they capture at the end. And the quote from the intelligence agent is, we're not amateurs. We do this for a living. You know, you don't want to spend your life in a corner of the Ecuadorian embassy. You don't want to be in solitary being tortured. You don't want to live in Russia without any hope of getting out. You want to take seriously what this has all turned into and what it is. I have two stories in here that are versions of each other, Northward Into the Night, which reveal in one story two layers and the other three layers, which the astute reader will see the difference. I have one called More Than a Dream, about an encounter with alien civilizations. I have one called Incident at Wolf Cove, which shows you the effects of an anomalous event on a psyche of a human being. It's all in here. It's the only way I can tell the truth. And it's the only way a spy novelist named Gerard de Villiers, a Frenchman, can tell the truth. You may not know his name. I'm just going to throw out that he wrote an astonishing story about Libya and what would happen there 3 months before it happened. He did a story about Syria, a novel about Syria, and the assassination in Lebanon of Hariri. And he named all the names, and the names were accurate. And people go to him and they read him, even though they say they don't because it's salacious pulp fiction, but it's always accurate. And he was invited to dinner by the Minister of Defense in France. And he said, I'm honored to be having dinner with you, but why did you ask me? He said, because it's clear you and I have exactly the same sources. He's not even read here. There's only one book you can get in English translation. But there's I think I put it in the bibliography, The Spy Novelist Who Knows Too Much in New York Times. Here's a bibliography. You know what they look like. You can't read it. But if you want it, give me your card afterward or connect with me at themeworks.com. And I'll be glad to respond to you with anything you want to know. I always say that I belong to this community. I belong to the seeking of truth. It is the true hacker ethos and the hacker heart. It is a lot like the game. The guy came into the Western town to play, and he said, I want the game. And he said, down to the saloon. And he went and he watched the roulette wheel for a while. And he said to the guy next to him, he said, you know, this game is crooked. He said, yeah, I know, but it's the only game in town. So you may not be able to play to win, but you got to play. Or else the red pill isn't even a lavender pill. It's a blue pill, and you're wholly owned, and you don't even know the loss of authenticity is the most corrosive power to your psyche, soul, and heart that the world can visit upon you. So connecting with one another in stealthy and appropriate ways in order to at least discover the truth, in order to strategize, to find a way, in little ways, to act on it in any way that might make a difference. That's really the heart of the hacker ethos. Okay, I've got a couple of minutes, and there's no Q&A room anymore, but I'll take Q&A out there at the bar, wherever I see you. I'm here until Sunday afternoon. And if you have a question now, got a question back there? Or are you just waving at me? Anybody have a question? Yes. On what exactly? I know I'm familiar with the book and I'm familiar with Chomsky's work. What my thoughts on? Do you think one came before the other? They thought of it, then it happened, and then they said, that's possible. That's all I can say is that's possible. There are different scenarios. I learned during the research for the UFO book that unless we can nail it down and make it bulletproof with solid documentation, all you can say is that's interesting and that's possible. But that's. That's all I can say. Anybody else? Question? Where?
At what point in your writing career did you decide to fictionalize the truth?
When my friend, the deputy director for Homeland Defense at the NSA, said to me directly, You can't talk about what we talk about with you. And then he paused and he said, unless you start writing fiction. Fiction is the only way you can tell the truth. That's a literal statement about a conversation we had personally. And I returned to writing short stories. As I said, I published 35 of them since then, and I'm about to finish a novel, and Mind Games was collected. There, Mind Games is about four kinds of non-consensual reality: intelligence work, hackers, encounters with alien civilizations, and deep states of consciousness and what we see and feel and experience when we genuinely have the courage to explore in a bathysphere the psychic connections between us and who we are as a kind of composite organism. It's four kinds of stories, and that's when I did it, because what he was saying made sense. And we took very deadly seriously the almost failed effort to try to inflect that conversation inside. You know how it hasn't happened, but there are words inside in policy which suggest people do something along the lines we suggested. But this is a huge issue, and when your task is to defend and protect America as you understand it, you put everything else on the back burner. And when you go into the White House in the morning when you're elected and they hand you the briefing from the night before, the 10 worst threats, any human being who's sane is going to say, what can you do to stop these? And when they tell you we can do this and this and this, you're going to say, do it. Do anything humanly possible to stop that.
That's it.
Question later?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate it.